The Major Spoilers podcast covers news, reviews, and of course, spoilers, and goes into details about the topics discussed. So if you haven't read, listened, or watched the items we talk about, you might want to come back later.
I'm Matthew.
I'm Rodrigo.
And I'm Steven, and you're listening to the Major Spoilers podcast, the podcast for pop culture and comic fans.
In this issue, so the problem with the 2020s is that all of the dystopian crapsack worlds and future horror stories feel too much like the world outside, but we're here with a full array of reviews, some Star Trek news, Rawhide's return, and a look at the Woman of Tomorrow. So remember the part about damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead, and forget the part about going in harm's way. Shoot if you must this old gray head, but spare my MSP, she said. Barbara Flitchell's words, them there, and the Major Spoilers podcast is on the air from a shave.
Welcome to issue 1017 of the Major Spoilers podcast. Thank you so much for downloading and checking us out this week. We do not have a Rand with us this week. I don't know why. We hope that he is well, and he is scheduled to show up, I believe, next week, because we are going to be talking about actually the next 2 weeks. So maybe he just needed a break from us.
He just needs a break.
I don't blame him. Anyway,
I don't either.
Let's do some news. The Penguin series on HBO Max is expanding its cast with the addition of Clancy Brown. Brown will play Sal Maroney, one of the crime bosses of Gotham City. The Penguin will be an 8-episode show and will continue the story that started in the Batman movie, which was released in 2022. Matt Reeves is the executive producer of the show. Colin Farrell is reprising his role as the title character. I'm kind of excited about seeing Clancy Brown in this show.
Yeah, fun times with Clancy Brown.
Mm. Why might we be even more interested in his character Sal Maroney?
Because it sounds like Sal Mineo, who was in East of Eden.
I was going to say probably because he's the one that throws the acid in Harvey Dent's face.
Oh,
so
is it?
Maybe we are going to see the introduction of a Two-Face, or at least a Harvey Dent, in this show. We know that there is another The Batman movie coming. It would not surprise me if we get a Sal Maroney throws some acid in Harvey Dent's face, and now the Batman has to deal with that in the next The Batman movie. The Batning.
Hope they give him a line about Lex Luthor having a weird voice.
I know, right?
I hope they give him a line about why that watermelon is there.
Yeah. 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 Clancy Brown's great in everything that he does. So I'm kind of excited about this. I mean, this may get me to resubscribe to HBO Max.
I still don't want to watch this Penguin show.
Oh, really? Okay. That's fine.
Clancy Brown is cool, but man.
Did you watch The Batman?
Yeah, I did. And I liked it a lot. Okay. But I'm really not sold on this Penguin show. Like, the Penguin wasn't even the best part of the Batman.
No, he wasn't. It really wasn't. I could have done a lot less of him and more of the Catwoman and Carmine Falcone stuff.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So anyway,
I mean, I keep meaning to watch the Batman, but I cannot find the wherewithal in me to sit down and, you know, console myself to 2.5 hours a movie.
It's a little bit longer than that.
Yeah. Yeah. It is long. Yeah.
It is long, but it's good. It's a solid movie. It really is a solid movie.
You know what, though? The Batman is the first superhero movie that I've watched twice in a long time. Like, probably since Thor Ragnarok. I haven't, like, sat down to watch Shang-Chi. I haven't sat down to rewatch
Everything Everywhere All at Once.
I haven't watched Everything Everywhere All at Once. I don't know that counts as a superhero movie, but if you are counting it, then no, I also haven't rewatched that. But I sat down to rewatch The Batman. It's, you know, it's pretty good.
Hmm.
All right, Rodrigo, jump in and give us another news bit.
All right. All good things must come to an end. After 5 seasons, Paramount has announced that the 5th season of Star Trek Discovery will be its last. Star Trek Discovery kicked off the modern wave of Star Trek shows, including the spin-off series Star Trek Strange New Worlds, which is prepping for its 2nd season, and Picard, which is ending with season 3. Variety is reporting the final season debut has been pushed to early 2024.
Anybody been watching Star Trek Discovery?
Not recently. I kind of watched a little bit of it early on, and then...
Yeah. I watched Picard. In fact, I saw episode one of Picard this weekend. But yeah, I have not been watching Discovery. I haven't watched Brave New World either, and I keep thinking maybe I should, but...
Yeah, no, I haven't watched this.
I have a friend who just lives for Discovery. He loves it. He's been talking about Discovery since the beginning. And so all that I know about Discovery and the Discovery plot points actually come from Chris at work. But yeah, he says it's great and he loves it. And he's also the person who said to me, you need to watch The Mandalorian. So, you know, you can kind of give him some leeway there.
It's funny because when Paramount Plus launched, they were like, yeah, here are all the new shows that we're working on. And it was all Star Trek shows. And it's like, is Star Trek the only franchise they have? And it kind of is. Less so now. But at the time, it really did seem that way. And though on the one hand, it makes it difficult to want to... If you're not into Star Trek, then it's like, well, what does this service do for me? But Star Trek fans have been eating good for the past few years. Like,
very true.
Four or five new Star Trek shows over the past like 5 years is a lot. And there's a lot of Star Trek content out there. So it's kind of a new renaissance, assuming you like it.
Yeah, and I have seen, and I know I mentioned this on the morning stream, and some people were like, what? What are you talking about? How can you have too much Star Trek? And the answer is, yeah, I have seen people say that there's too much Star Trek. And so maybe Paramount finally listened, and that's why we don't have why this Discovery is ending. Picard is ending. And is there one more Star Trek thing ending? I can't remember, but there we are.
It's not ending, but they have Prodigy.
Oh, yeah, right.
And Lower Decks.
Yeah, Lower Decks, I thought they said was... like on a super hiatus. But I can't remember why I thought I saw that.
Yeah. Hey, look, everybody, there's Rand. Everybody point and look at Rand and say, hi, Rand.
Rand. Hello.
Welcome. Rand. Welcome.
No idea what happened, but I'm glad to be here.
All right. Do you watch Star Trek? Are you a Star Trek fans?
I have seen every single episode of the new Trek. I think the only Trek I haven't seen every episode of is probably, well, I guess, what was the Enterprise?
Enterprise, the flashback one?
Yeah, that's the only one I haven't seen. So
is the Spock in Brave New Worlds the same Spock from Discovery?
Yes.
Okay. And he is implicitly the same Spock that we know from the original series.
I mean, whether it's unclear whether this is an alternate universe, but it is the same Spock from Discovery for sure.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And okay. It's strange.
So this is not like Kelvin timeline stuff.
Yeah. A lot of people do. Anyway. Well, good to have you here, Rand. Matthew's going to wrap us up with our last news story for this week.
Some stories in the news. Atomic Monster and Blumhouse are teaming to adapt the Dead by Daylight game franchise into a feature film. If you've played the game, you know the players take on the role of survivor. Or the role of killer, with the killers taking on the appearance and abilities of some of horror's greatest characters as they stalk and kill the other players in the game. Because that's what I want, is for the other players in the game to kill me. No word on a release date for the movie, although I do hope that allows me to play either side.
Like, game you can. Yeah. That's the whole point. You can either be the killer.
It's a Black Mirror episode couple years ago where you could choose your own adventure. That's what I want out of this movie.
Honestly, it's a lot more pressure to be the killer. I haven't played Dead by Daylight, but I've played other games that are like that. And being the one that has to figure out where everybody is and actually have the manual dexterity to kill them is pretty hard sometimes.
Well, all of my dexterity is automatic.
I will be very interested to see how they do this, because one of the big draws for Dead by Daylight is that you could play Freddy Krueger. You could play Ghostface. You can play Jason. And it's like, are they going to be able to get all of those IPs in this? Or is it just going to be a generic Scream ripoff?
Yeah, it is weird with stuff like this that is already starts out as genre savvy, right? Mm-hmm. It's like if they made a movie out of Zombicide, how would that movie be different from any other zombie movie, since Zombicide specifically draws on zombie movie tropes to create the moments in the game, right? So it's like, yeah, if you take it from a piece of media that is very, I mean, I don't want to say derivative, but it's like very sort of worshipful of the medium, what's going to be there to set it apart when it like moves over?
Yeah. So if they could land all those properties and have them thrown in, that would be amazing. But my guess is they're going to use the base characters that started with the game, you know, the Crooked Lady and some of the other spooky stuff. And that's what that's what it's going to be. But I have a feeling many fans would rather they get to do Freddy Krueger and those other guys.
It makes you wonder, though, when you license those characters to be in your game, could there be some sort of agreement in there on, hey, you know, if we transition to another media, we can do X, Y, or Z, or we can, you know, try and renegotiate.
There
something.
Might be, but my guess would be very much like the Fortnite franchise is you're getting this stuff for this specific purpose only. Right. Because if you try to do anything else with that, then it's going to cause confusion. So,
and if it was Warner Brothers doing this movie, then they could talk, because some of those villains belong to WB or any other company, but it's Atomic Monster and Blumhouse. So I don't like, they're not going to have that access to those libraries of characters.
Does Blumhouse own like their own? Don't they have some though?
They could possibly do that.
Let's do it with all their own Blumhouse monsters. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Brand, do you play video games much?
You know, I really don't. And the last, I had an Atari 2600. I guess gaming in general, like I said, like, you know, obviously I've been, you know, most of my friends are really into whether it be tabletop gaming or video games. You know, one of my best friends in the world, you know, is, a lead programmer, you know, I certainly am around it and aware of it, but it's never been something that I've personally been passionate about.
I understand that. As much as I want to get into video games, every time I buy a new game, I get to play for like 2 or 3 hours, and then 6 months go by and I haven't touched anything. So that's why I started doing the Twitch streaming all those years ago, because it's like, this is the only way I can guarantee that I get to play video games for 2 or 3 hours a week. So,
yeah.
Anyway,
the trick is to just have one game that you play and play it like for a few hours a week over the course of 10 years. And then you can be like me. I just hit a level 1100 wizard in Diablo 3.
Right.
Yeah.
Dear listeners, you can join in this conversation and more over on our Discord. You can join the Major Spoilers Discord server for free, totally free in this day and age. What can you get for free? Well, you're listening to this podcast for free, and now you can join our Discord server for free. Come and hang out with some awesome people. You can talk about pretty much anything. We've got different channels for different shows, different categories, movies, TV, reading, sports ball, video games, so much more. There's a link in the show notes, and we cannot wait to share all of our cat gifts with you when you join. All right, reviews time. And I think, let's see, everybody except Matthew and I jumped into the future. So I will start off with brand new today, Adventures of Superman John Kent #1 from Tom Taylor and Clayton Henry over at DC Comics. This is a multiverse story where across the multiverse, a bunch of Kal-Els are being murdered by none other than Ultraman. That's not a spoiler. It happens in the first two pages. So Ultraman is going from universe to universe and killing the Kal-Els. And in, I don't know, whatever universe the main DC story is taking place right now, if it's Earth Zero, we get to see John Kent trying to go about his life when all of a sudden all these satellites are falling from the sky. And he's trying to get the Teen Titans involved to help out and stop these things from destroying cities. And all of a sudden, a bunch of satellites just start disappearing before they hit their mark. And Jonathan goes to Germany where the last one was about to hit, and he finds Val Zod. And it's like, that's pretty cool. Yeah, from Earth 2. And he also finds the Red Tornado, I also believe from Earth 2. Later turns out to be Lois Lane. And
yeah, the Earth 2 Lois Lane
is Red Tornado. Yeah, okay, so that's not a super spoiler. And so basically Val Zod and Red Tornado and Mr. Terrific, because Mr. Terrific has to vouch for Val Zod and Red Tornado that he knows who they are. They're basically like, look, all the Kal-Els on Earth are dying, or are on the multiverse are dying. We're trying to prevent that, because as soon as an Earth, as soon as a Superman or a Clark Kent of that Earth dies, the planet soon falls after. And they know that it's Ultraman, which of course triggers John Kent, because all that time when he was gone and he got aged up was when Ultraman had him locked away on another dimension and torturing him. And so there's some retribution that needs to go on with this. This issue is a lot of setup. I thought it's great to see a bunch of different Supermans. I do like me a out of control Ultraman story, because when he finally gets taken down, it's always good to see that big bully just get his comeuppance. I like John Kent just trying to be John Kent and not always having to worry about being Superman. So I think that that's really good. I like that Lois is very concerned that her son is getting involved in this until she hears Red Tornado tell her story. The one thing that is maybe kind of spoilerish and maybe not kind of spoilerish, especially if you're looking at the cover of the issue, is you see a Jonathan Kent and he's got like electricity and lightning jumping around all around him. Mm-hmm. And in the story, he's like, oh, something weird is happening. I'm having this weird sensation. And he's like, I felt this during the Lazarus Planet event, which is what they reference. And, you know, he's getting this glowy electricity thing and then it goes away. I have a weird feeling, and I don't want this to be the case, but I have a weird feeling that they are trying to do The One with Jet Li. Whereas in every universe, a Kal-El dies and the power gets transferred to all the other Kal-Els, or in this case, John Kent. And so he's getting powered up by the death of all these Supermans. I don't know if that's the case. That's me speculating, and I really hope it's not The One, because as much as I enjoyed that movie at the time, it's not that good of a movie. So Adventures of Superman, John Kent, really love the art in this, although I think Clayton Henry draws the next a little bit too long. That's my only complaint. Other than that, 4 out of 5 slices of meatloaf. Really enjoyed this issue from start to finish, and I think if you're looking for something to pick up on that's definitely not going to, I don't think that this is an ongoing, I think this is a miniseries, this is a great way to kick off a miniseries. So go check it out. It's out this week, out right now from DC Comics. Matthew, you are taking a look at Clear Number One. This is from Image Comics. Now, this is also something that is a Comixology original. So this has already been reviewed on the Major Spoilers website. The whole series has been reviewed on the Major Spoilers website months ago. But one of the things that Comixology is doing is they are working with companies like Image Comics and Dark Horse Comics to take their originals digital first series and then, you know, 6 months, 8 months later, bring them to print. And so in this case, instead of getting a trade collection like we might see at Boom or Dark Horse, we're getting the individual issue releases tomorrow, Wednesday. Clear Number One from Scott Snyder and Francis Manapal.
Oh, man, now I feel bad. I didn't realize. Okay, so Clear Number One, Scott Snyder, Francis Manapul. This is important, and I feel like it's important because of the fact that it is, I believe, creator-owned. They are credited as co-creators. So we know that Manapul is the artist. We know that Snyder is primarily a writer. But I feel like that co-creator credit is important here, because this definitely feels different from things that I've seen from Scott Snyder and different from things that I've seen Francis Manapul write. But essentially, the future in the year 2052, that year, by the way, I'm going to be like, I don't know, 80, 85. I'll probably just hang it around. Rather than go into a, you know, a weird sort of dystopian crazy world where everything's a robot, or a world where we can teleport, or a world where everybody has spaceships and things are mostly good, we have taken the internet to its logical extreme, and anyone and everyone can purchase a veil. And a veil allows you to alter your perception of the world around you. So if you want to look around and have the world be a Looney Tunes cartoon, no matter what's happening, you can. If you want it to be a weird zombie movie by George Romero, you can. And so virtually everyone is wearing some sort of veil. And depending on what kind of veil you want, you may pay more. There are apparently people who live in a world of pornography, and I think they probably pay more. But our main character, Detective Dunes, does not have a veil. He is clear. So he sees the world as it really is, which is apparently the most expensive option of them all. Which I think actually kind of says a lot about the story. And I feel like that is really the one hook. That's the part where when I was reading this, I went, oh. And so other than that, other than a kind of a cyberpunk vibe and this futuristic take on, yes, the internet exists and people have access to all of this, we then proceed with a noir tale. And I feel like, Stephen, if you haven't read this, you probably
I did read it, and I was going to review it this week, but then I was like, no, I think someone already reviewed it on the site, so I did not.
Oh, yeah, I went back as far as I could, and I'm like, well, I can't find anything, and it's out this week, so clearly it's fine. So my mea culpa to those who might yell at me or be disappointed, but here's the thing. Now you get my take. So Detective Dunes is in the middle of a thing, nearly gets killed by a bad guy who wants to kill him. The bad guy, of course, is selling counterfeit veils, what they call black veils. When he finds that an old friend slash possible girlfriend, Kendra, is dead. She committed suicide, and everything is, you know, weird and strange, and he looks around the world, and it's a terrible, depressing world because, of course, it's either old and run down, or it's new, and because of the existence of veils, all the new building, all of the new clothing, all of the new stuff is as nondescript as possible, so as not to interfere with whatever veil you have. So all the architecture is this bare, rudimentary, brutalist nonsense. But Dunes actually went back and had to dig up antiques so that he has actual clothing that he can, you know, look at and like the style of. And he has books. He has, you know, items in his possession, things that exist so that he can have them. And one of the things is his watch. And he bought an identical one for Kendra. And it comes back to him in the mail. And inscribed on the back is, I was murdered. Now, the good part about this, if you're picking this up in the print copy from Dark Horse, it is two chapters. So it is 48 pages worth of story. And as we have mentioned many, many times, having more stuff in your first issue is always a good thing. So had I gotten to that particular point, that, you know, hook point when this came out and I were reading it a week at a time or a month at a time or however it came out, I would be like, oh, this is pretty okay. But then the second chapter gives us a little more backstory. We find out who Alka-Ten, the evil guy, is. We find out a little bit of the connection between our main character and Kendra. And we find out that she used to work in the DOC, the Department of Connectivity. One of her jobs back in the day was to help wounded soldiers to maintain their veils when they're injured. So if you have a head injury, it makes it hard for your brain to interface with the computer and make sure that you're not looking at actual reality. She was actually essentially a physical therapist, only for your psychotic, crazy, glow-in-the-dark imaginary reality. That's fascinating. This is five slices of meatloaf, because by the end of this second chapter, I'm like, yeah, I'm buying this. I'm going to go buy this book. I'm going to read it. I'm going to love it. But more importantly, if it's all out there, I may go download it tomorrow.
It's all out there. Yeah, you can get it. If you have a, I don't know if it's Amazon Prime. I don't know if you get your Comixology with Amazon Prime or not. But if you have a Comixology account, it's zero cost to you.
Wow. I have a Comixology account, but I have a lot of trouble using it. And it's a whole schmageggy. But I will say this, if you have not read this book, definitely grab it. I mean, even if you're at a store and you see it, this is really, really good. Manipul is one of those artists who I've always really enjoyed. he started out with a style that was kind of a little more sketchy or brutalist than I liked, but it's, you know, it's now to the point where clearly the man knows exactly what he's doing. And this book takes place in a not real world, but a realistic world. And Stephen will tell you Scott Snyder's a genius all day long.
No, not necessarily, but I do enjoy his work.
Yeah. And I enjoyed this book. I didn't necessarily always, you know, as with so many artists, I don't necessarily love them in a shared universe setting, but man, you give Snyder room to go out and just create and you get something really, really special. Five slices of meatloaf. Doop-de-doop-de-doop.
Very good. Rand, it has been probably, 40 years maybe since I saw the movie Hawk the Slayer. And apparently 2000 AD. Yeah, it's been a while. Anyway, there is a comic book. I don't know if it's a sequel or an adaptation of the movie.
No, it is the sequel that you've been waiting for since 1980.
All right.
I am reviewing the graphic novel collection, which is going to come out on March 28th. But all of these issues are currently available, both digitally and in print. If you can't wait till then, it's called Hawk the Slayer. The subtitle is Watch for Me in the Night. It is written by Garth Ennis, who most of you, I'm sure, are familiar with from Preacher, The Boys, Hitman, Punisher, etc. And it is illustrated by Henry Flint, who is not to be confused with the 80s American comic book artist Flint Henry. I'm not making that up. They're two different humans. This is Henry Flint, who's a British. He's done most of his work through 2000 AD. This is indeed published by 2000 AD and Rebellion. And like I said, it's coming out on March 28th. It is, as you said, it is a sequel to the 1980, Sword and Sorcery film that was starring Jack Palance and John Terry. like many, many movies that from our youth that came out around this time, it owed way too much to Star Wars. And in fact, you know, like the bad guy, Jack Palance plays the bad guy, Voltan, and his helmet is kind of embarrassingly like Darth Vader's.
Believe it.
Yeah.
But so you have Hawk is your hero, and Voltan, who's the bad guy, is his brother. And at the end of the movie, he was, you know, killed, and he is, you know, mysteriously brought back from the dead. You know, he's kind of a, you know, walking corpse through this whole thing. The two survivors from the film, other than Hawk, from his team, Gort the Giant and Crow the Archer, who, of course, is Elfin, because they're not really trying to get points for originality here. They return, and the team is rounded out by Bella the Warrior and Wayne the Bard, and they're fighting the Black Wizards. It's like a new Led Zeppelin album, okay? I mean, it's exactly what you would expect. This is, again, like these guys, they're not, it's pretty standard stuff. They are not trying to be original. They're not trying to, you know, but, you know, if you've read Garth Ennis, you know, he's too good a writer for this to be terrible. I will say, I'm glad that I'm not reviewing the first issue and then I'm reviewing the whole thing, because the first issue is pretty uninspired. You know, a lot of it's just kind of trying too hard to sum up the movie while also, you know, for those of us that weren't, you know, people that didn't see the movie 50 years ago. And it's also trying to set up the sequel. And so it's, you know, it gets a lot better after the first issue, I guess is what I'm saying.
Okay, good.
Flint's storytelling is really top notch. I mean, the art looks good. But more importantly, there isn't a single panel that is confusing or that isn't moving the story forward in a clear manner. Like last week, we were talking about Die, as beautiful as it looked. Sometimes the storytelling was a little hard to follow. This does not suffer from that. Everything is very clear. You know exactly what's happening. I mentioned that it had a slow start. And like I said, if you're looking for a wholly original take on Sword and Sorcery, you will absolutely be disappointed. But the story builds nicely and it ends up being pretty fun. It had a really, like, the climax of this, like the action climax in the last issue, and the way that they dispatched the big bad at the end was exactly as clever as you might come to expect from Garth Ennis. That was fun. I will, one little thing, I kept, like, there's this character of the Bard who's kind of a typical weird Garth Ennis trope where he's, you know, he's totally useless and like most of his purpose in the story is to be made fun of. Like, mm-hmm. ha ha, he, you know, doesn't do anything, you know, like this guy, he sure is useless, isn't he? I kept expecting that there would be something at the end that would make that worth it. Like either it would be, you know, either he would somehow become important to their victory or he would maybe die horribly following mm-hmm. an unexpectedly brave speech or something, you know, mm-hmm. which is a well that Garth has certainly gone to more than once. Nothing really comes of him. I mean, the only thing you get is you get like a kind of epilogue scene. It would kind of almost be like a mid-credit scene in a movie where, you know, he's told that his purpose was to, you know, be the bard to write the song that would immortalize the story. And he's like, screw that. That's stupid. And walks away. You know, which again,
that's a very Garth Ennis ending, right? Yeah,
exactly. Not the worst idea, but it just seemed like, wow, like that whole, that character was in the story just for that, you know? So, I mean, yeah, for me, it's, this is definitely, you know, it's right down the middle. It's 3 out of 5. No, I mean, if you like this sort of story, this is a fun story, but it's certainly, if you love Sword and Sorcery comics, that you don't need to start here. If you love Garth Ennis, you certainly don't need to start here. But if you like both of those things, there are a lot worse ways to spend a couple hours of your life.
There you go. Very good. Thank you so much for that, Rand. And then Rodrigo had to pick a comic that comes out a day after Hawk the Slayer.
Mm-hmm.
Don't Spit in the Wind, number one.
Yeah. Gotta be the futurist person.
You are going, okay. What, almost towards the end of the month. You're 20 days ahead, 22 days ahead.
Yeah. What year is it? No. Don't Spit in the Wind is a comic book by Stefano Cardoselli. And it's put out by Mad Cave Studios. We've been looking at a lot of stuff from Mad Cave recently. And the premise of it is humans have polluted the world and trashed it to a degree where it's impossible to live on it anymore. And so everybody's moved to a big space station that orbits the Earth. But there are companies that are trying to clean up the Earth. And this book is about some of the employees of the Atomic Bros Incorporated mm-hmm. company that is trying to clean up the world, reduce radiation, etc. And some of their employees, mainly Travis, we're kind of in his head as we go through this. Travis walks around in a big sort of like power suit. Think more like the suits from Fallout than like a mech, but it's almost like a mm-hmm. small mech. And he has a team, or he's part of a team, and basically all that happens in this issue is we see what the world is like. We see that his fiance also works for this company doing something very different. She's like in this like sky barge or something. And then one of the units fails to report in. So they're like, okay, you're the closest, so go check on it. And so he goes over and then he like finds someone else and he's like, okay, well, you're a little closer than I am, so you go check or you come with me to check. So they go check and they realize that something bad has happened to that unit. Something bad has happened to McGlusky. Also, a horrendous plague of locusts appear. And that's kind of where the book leaves off. I like it a lot. I really like the art. It is colorful, but like really cluttered in like a good way. It's got... it's a little bit reminiscent of, it's like it's got a little, definitely got a little Mabius in there. I feel like it's got a little Jamie Hewlett in it as well. If you guys get a chance to look at it, probably some like 2008 like Judge Dredd stuff as well. It's very cool. You know, it's like this aesthetic where like this looks cool because it very clearly was not meant to look cool. There's like all these like pipes and gears and stuff coming out of things. It's like very clearly meant to be functional, but it's like so overwrought that it like comes back around. Really, really dig the art. I'm going to give it 4 slices of meatloaf. I'm interested to see what McGlusky came across. And yeah, I actually really like the art.
Very, very cool. Very, very nice. Dear listeners, if you want even more reviews, all you need to do is point your browser over to majorspoilers.com. Thank you to everyone who supports the show and all the shows in the Major Spoilers Podcast Network. This week, we're sending our thanks to Catherine Beard, who changed their pledge to a yearly pledge and saved some money, too. We also want to give a shout out to Mark Wiggins, our newest silver level member. We're waiting to give you a shout out on the show. All you need to do is join us over at patreon.com/majorspoilers. This week, we are talking about Supergirl, Woman of Tomorrow. And I will say, I love this book from the very first issue that came out way back when. I've been pushing Scott Johnson every chance I get to read this series. I think he finally has read the series because he loves Westerns. And ultimately, Supergirl is True Grit meets superheroes, as told by Tom King and Bill Quisevilly. And it follows Kara Zor-El has gone far off into space to a red solar system so that she doesn't have to, she doesn't have her powers, and she's 21. And that means she can drink and she wants to get drunk. And to do that, she needs to be under a red sun. Meanwhile, there is a horrible, horrible guy who has killed a young girl's father. And the young girl wants revenge. She wants to kill this guy for killing her paw. And she has asked Kara Zor-El to kill this man for her. And Kara says, yeah, I'll do it. And they go on a long, winding adventure to track down this man through the backwaters of space. And along the way, also, this bad man has shot Kara Zor-El's dog, Crypto. And so you know this guy is bad if he's going to shoot a dog.
Oh, she's going to John Wick him.
I mean, yeah. And so this is a tale that is told in hindsight from Ruthie's perspective. Years later, these are the events that happen. She publishes a book off of this. And it is a story about revenge that is shaded through compassion, is I guess how I would describe it. And I kind of want to know what you guys think, because Tom King is very polarizing to people. You either hate him, you tolerate him, or you love him. I guess that's not polarizing, because that would be three. You would be a tripod on that. But you either love him or hate him, according to the peoples that are out there.
A triple pole.
Yeah.
I'm weird about Tom King because... God, what was it that he just finished? Human Target.
Human Target, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Human Target, I felt like, was 11 issues of sheer beauty. And then an ending that I didn't care for.
Well, I haven't read the final issue yet, but, I mean, that is DOA. That's his take on DOA with superheroes. So, you know, the Human Target is going to die at the end. He's not going to be saved if you're going to follow that DOA format. So,
which is fine.
Yeah, and so I don't know if that is...
Comic, I'm good with it.
Yeah.
I actually.
But what'd you think about this one, then?
The story has an end. And I feel like, on a scale of first 11 issues of The Human Target to the polar opposite of Heroes in Crisis, which is just a punch in the testicles in comic book form, this is a good, solid 8.5 for me. This avoid some of the pitfalls to the point where I remember
dueling review of issue one. Yeah.
Okay. I remember issue one vividly, and I remember a couple of other issues, and I think I reviewed somewhere down the line, like 7 or something, but I remember the visuals of the story so vividly, so beautiful. And that first issue cover of, you know, a 21-year-old Carol with the sword over her head, that just stuck with me. The basic story itself is nuanced enough that I remembered kind of the feel of it, the tone, the emotions, without actually remembering damn near anything that happened in the comic, which in a lot of ways, that's fun. That's good, because I came away from it thinking, I remember this being very upsetting. You know, I was very nervous going into issue one because I remember being bugged, but I didn't remember by what. And then he shot Crypto. Oh. But as with any trope, you know, even the hated, hey, I'm going to kill a whole bunch of children to show how evil I am, can be done in a way that informs and, you know, entertains and makes for a good story. And I feel like that moment of, oh God, we're going to go off into a side nonsense here, that kind of didn't go where I thought it was going to go. But yeah, I feel like, honestly, I remember most of this for the Billquist side of things. And so I can take or leave Tom King, because other than that weird moment where those guys are clearly MODOK, I wasn't ever put off by the story. I didn't ever go, oh God, we're doing this now, which is something that I do say to myself in certain stories by this particular writer. So.
Well, I think that there are some interesting points in here, because the main bad guy hooks up with a bunch of kill pirates, and these guys just go from town to planet, system to system, mm-hmm. just killing everybody unless they pay up. And even if they do pay up, they may still kill them all. And so each time they're coming across these guys, it really solidifies in I think many readers' minds that anything that Supergirl is going to do to these guys is totally justified. And if she wants to kill these guys, it's totally justified. And if Ruthie, you know, can convince her to kill all these guys, then it's totally justified. And yet what you get at the end, when you do have that moment of, yeah, Supergirl, kill these bad people, you know, Ruthie steps forward and says, no, I learned this valuable lesson about compassion, even in dark times and understanding and all of these things that, you know, it's called, you know, Woman of Tomorrow. Just, you know, it's unfortunately, I think Supergirl is always going to be stuck with the Supergirl moniker, no matter how old she is. But throughout this story, to me, it feels like Supergirl is showing all of the compassion and all of the traits that Superman tries to show in his daily life. Now, Supergirl is not Superman. She has her own faults. She was not born on Earth. She has a past on Krypton that also impacts and influences her. But I just really like the simple acts of kindness and compassion that she's trying to show Ruthie throughout the entire story. Ren, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, this is probably the first time that I'm not sure I agree with anything you've said.
Okay.
So I think the story, like many Tom King stories, is about Supergirl's PTSD.
I can see that.
I think it's about her inability to process the horror of her life, about how damaged she is, and about how she's been ignoring the damage. You know, it's very similar to Heroes in Crisis in that sense, very similar to Sheriff of Babylon. And I should say, I've been a fan of Tom King since the first issue of Sheriff of Babylon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I like Tom King a lot. There's a lot to chew on here, and, you know, certainly a lot to like. The bones of the story are super solid. I think this is why, you know, James Gunn is so excited about making this into a movie, because you can strip it of everything but the bones and it's going to hold together. You know, so in other words, you know, a filmmaker, a screenwriter can hang a bunch of new flesh on this, you know, and that's what Hollywood likes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they want to, you know, a Philip K. Dick short story that they can add their own stuff to, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Well, I think that'll be great. Obviously, you know, as Matthew said, the art, you know, is, you know,
well, Bill Quist, pretty great. I have been a fan of hers since the first work I ever saw that she did in a Legion of Superheroes backup story. And I forget what DC Comics it was years ago. I think it was actually her first American work. And anytime I can see any of her stuff, it just blows me out of the water. She is fantastic. I just love her art top to bottom.
I'm with you there. Absolutely. But I guess I really was put off. And again, we can get to, you know, we're going to talk about the ending. We'll get to the ending.
Yeah.
Before we do that, I was put off from the very beginning by the narration.
Mm.
I felt like, you know, like one of the strengths of Tom King's work is how sparse it is. And I felt this was overwritten. It read like a 70s, you know, cosmic Marvel comic, you know, because, you know, obviously the concept of having the text be narration from a book means that it has to be overwritten. And what I mean by that is that when you read a comic, you know, the difference between a book and a comic is that a book, you have to describe things narratively mm-hmm. that you can be imaged in a comic. And so when the text of the comic is from a book, it's by the very conceit, it's going to be overwritten.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like it was overwritten. And again, like I said, a lot of 70s Marvel comics, you know, were clearly written by frustrated novelists sure. or failed novelists.
So the one thing that I would counter into that, and that does lead to the actual ending of the book. I think the book could have ended a page earlier and I would have been much happier. is that it is setting up an unreliable narrator.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely.
And I think that's
important. The unreliable narrator is unreliably unreliable.
yeah.
There are a lot of layers here.
Yeah. Oh, no. And I think that that's the thing. And that's why I think I can come away with my interpretation of the book and you can have your interpretation of the book. And they're still both valid because that's how we read and interacted with the piece. And so right. I think you're absolutely right in what you're saying there. I just was looking at the nice, quiet moments as opposed to the I'm going to punch that guy in the head moments.
Right. And exactly. Because, like, I mean, what you're talking about with the unreliable narrator is that we learn at the end that the narrative we've been reading, that is to say the published book, the text of which we've been reading, is fictional.
Right.
You know what I mean? And what we've been seeing, the visuals we've been seeing, or the comic, is reality. But that separation only is clear in the last issue.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, was the narrator unreliable the whole time or just in that moment at the end? The climax is unreliable, meaning that what we see, in, you know, what is, can I spoil it or no? Is that a,
I mean, Rodrigo, do you want to jump in with anything real quick?
I didn't like Sheriff of Babylon that much. No.
Let's talk about Omega Man.
Yeah. So I did enjoy it. I'm the first one to kick a book to the curb if it's wordy, but I did enjoy the narration because it's so seldom that you get to see. And when I realized this is what was happening, I super got into it. You very seldom get to see a comic book narrated by an old lady. Right. Mm. It's like it's either narrated as it's happening by a brooding guy. It's like this, it was raining in the city. The city is like a whore being pelted by smaller whores, which is the rain. Right. And or it's something else. Or it's nice to see this like kind of Watson or Sancho Panza type character that is tagging along with Supergirl, even though Supergirl is trying to basically help her with her quest. It's fun to see this character. It's fun to see it be, you know, an elderly woman thinking back about what meeting this goddess was like. So after a little while, I definitely, like, what I would do is I would open a page, look at all the text boxes and go like, ugh. And then, like, I would, like, skip around. And then I was like, well, now I kind of want to read what the rest of it says. So I would actually spend more time reading the boxes because I kept doing that until I finally just gave up and just read all the text.
At what point did you realize the narrator was unreliable?
Pretty much from the beginning, I suspected that she was.
Okay.
And I don't know if I completely agree with Rand's assessment that the pictures are true, but the narrative is
there not. Is. Okay. So
I think there's room for it to be. The pictures are part of the narrative until the narrative and the pictures like separate. And so I think it is unreliable to know whether things happened exactly the way that they did. Just like in Life of Pi, why would anybody make up that a horse got shot and turned into a dude?
Right. I think for me, I realized there was some problems with the narration when, and I think it was Purple Town, when she's like, I had to do all this research later to find out what was really going on. And I had to do, and she keeps talking about, I forgot about these things until I went and looked at them. And I was like, well, that doesn't seem quite right. But I think the moment where you realize that the visuals are what are really happening, and it's really in the 11th issue, and it may have even been the back cover or whatever, or a teaser cover, there is a shot, and I don't have it here in front of me at the moment, but there is a shot of Supergirl sitting on the beach looking up into the sky, and there is a bloody sword stuck in the sand behind her, and she's just looking up as this is it. And I think it was the end of the, or I'm sorry, the 7th issue going into the 8th issue. And to me, that was like, wait a minute, did she kill all the pirates? Did she do the thing that she said she wasn't going to do? We only have Supergirl's account to Ruthie about what happened on that pirate ship. We don't know, but that image seemed to reflect, oh, this is the reality of what really happened. And that sword doesn't get bloody unless that sword was used by anybody. And so at that point, I was very concerned going into that last issue where Rand, what ends up happening? What is the big reveal of the story?
Oh, I'm not sure. You know, I may be thinking something different, but to me, like, you know, the big reveal for me is that, like, you know, where it becomes where the text itself reveals that the narrator is unreliable.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, I'm talking about the big spoiler ending that you wanted to share.
Oh, well, the big spoiler ending is that, again, in, you know, the first time we see the ending, so Ruthie is unable to kill Krem, and then Supergirl kills Krem. Mm-hmm. You know, and then in our epilogue, Supergirl and Krem meet much later in life, and Supergirl asks Ruthie, why did you change the ending?
Yeah.
Am I remembering this correctly?
Yeah, no, and so
I'm sorry. Yeah. And then you're talking about Krem in the Phantom Zone.
Right.
Yeah. And then, you know, and yeah, this is the part that was, I think that most people probably found head scratching. Krem comes out of the Phantom Zone where he's been for hundreds of years. He appears to be completely rehabilitated. He begs for forgiveness, you know, acknowledges his, you know, the fact that he was a terrible, horrible person. And then Ruthie kills him. Mm-hmm. And again, I want to be clear, and I imagine we all want to be clear. Ruthie is under no obligation to forgive Krem.
Right.
This is how long he suffered,
and that's the thing.
His repentance.
If
he is under no obligation to forgive him.
So there is a moment, right? So there is a page turn where he is begging forgiveness and saying, I'm sorry. If the issue ended there, I think that would have been the best ending for it. But you flip to the other page, and then you see her take the sword, kill him, and then Supergirl and Ruthie go on their own way. And at that point, I was like, well, I'm not sure I like that ending. But then I had to think, it's like, no, this is a story about revenge, and revenge is not about forgiveness. And so if you're going with the hardcore revenge story, it makes sense that she would have to kill him at the end, even if he is begging for forgiveness.
It does.
I don't think she kills him.
You think that's unreliable?
No. Just look at the panels, right? So okay. Top panel, she hits him. Mm-hmm. Bottom panel, you can see his arm, and then his arm moves to his head, and then after they're gone, it drops. I think she just hit him really hard in the face.
Mm. And okay.
Okay.
Like, and he so just like chose to stay Batman there.
Did, you know, was Batman reaching to lean on the Joker as he laughed, yes, or was he choking him to death, right, and breaking his neck, is what you're saying? Right.
So this is fascinating, because we have four different interpretations of this book. And I think that that's what part of what makes Tom King both loved and hated at the same time.
Yeah. And it does bring up the question of if a story can be four different things to four different people on a podcast who work together, who have, you know, a knowledge of each other's back and forth and may have shared each other's perspectives in the past, does that make the story more successful, or does it make the story less successful because it's unclear what it was actually trying to do?
Right. That's like my, yeah, my big question is, what's the point? And what I mean is not, you know, I mean, you could ask, you could be a jerk and say, what's the point of the comic? Mm-hmm. I say, like, what's the point? Like, something else that happens in the 12th issue. The 12th issue, I did it again. Something happens in the last issue, in the 8th issue.
Yeah.
Is that Supergirl says to Ruthie, oh, like, you know, like the crypto was a MacGuffin the whole time. You know what I mean? That right. didn't matter. All of this right. was about me trying to teach you a lesson. Well, what lesson? You know, like, I think, you know, so, like, if it's just about, like, it's fine if you want to tell a revenge story where wronged, you know, girl, you know, dedicates her life to tracking down evil man and kills him. If that's your story, great. But why muddy the water with this business about, you know, Supergirl teaching Ruthie a lesson?
Well, and that's the thing that I got, is that Supergirl is trying to teach her that it's not about revenge. Revenge is the easy way. The hard way is to show compassion for another person, to show, you know, that maybe killing isn't the answer, right? And I think that is it in the revenge. And maybe just punching him hard in the face after he's begged forgiveness is all that she needs. But when Ruthie starts her quest, she is dead set on killing this guy. And maybe just taking a moment to stop and think is what you need to do. And Supergirl says, had I not accepted your quest and taken you on this long journey, had I said no and walked away and went back to Earth, you would have gone out and tried to kill this guy anyway, and you would have been dead in the process.
Hmm. Right. But had the story ended with her, what I'm saying is that wouldn't the best way to teach that lesson be to have Ruthie have the opportunity to kill him with a sword?
And she does
not do that. Yeah. And then have Supergirl take him away to the Phantom Zone. Wouldn't that have taught the lesson better? I'm saying, like, other than cruelty and torturing this guy, what's the point of throwing him in the Phantom Zone for hundreds of years and then bringing him out and have her punch him in the face?
I mean, that would be the justice. I mean, that would be justice, right? That's the equivalent of putting him in jail. And so the justice is, you know, if you are going to kill somebody, then if you're going to do what Superman does, if you're going to do what a hero does, you don't kill the person. You put them in jail. You have justice served upon them. And she talks about the people in the Phantom Zone. That was like the first 100 years, all he could do is curse and hate people. And then the next 200 years, he started to question his why he was there. And then in the last 100 years, he accepted his responsibility for his actions. So that's like the parole board saying, you know, what's happening. So Ruthie is tempted. You see her holding up that sword in the 7th issue, and she's like, I can't do it because I've learned these lessons from Supergirl.
So I'm saying that seems like, if that's the point, as you said, if the point mm-hmm. is, then that scene demonstrates it.
The scene at the end.
Scene where Ruthie, right. whose entire life has been about getting this guy alone in a room with a sword so she can kill him.
Right.
And bring herself to kill him when she has a sword. And it's not because she's afraid. It's not because she's weak. Mm-hmm. It's because she's been changed. She's been transformed by these experiences.
Right.
You know, if that's the story, if that's the message, then it's communicated there. It seems like everything that happens after that muddies the water.
Yeah, I would agree with you.
The point of the story.
And that's why I'm questioning Supergirl's thing about why did you change the ending? Because is the ending that Supergirl finally broke when Comet died and she killed all those pirates? Is that the ending that's been changed?
And then she killed him.
So in these extremely controversial final panels, that's literally the ending. That narration is literally the ending of the book. Something that we've seen didn't happen. Mm-hmm.
Right. Oh, right. Okay. I see what you're saying. Yeah. So you're saying, okay, so my interpretation of that issue is that Ruthie talked Supergirl down from killing Krem. Mm-hmm. And you're saying that she didn't, that she did kill Krem.
No, I'm saying that you're right. She did talk him out of it, but Ruthie changed the ending and said that she did.
Right.
Okay. Exactly. I see what you're saying. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. That is my reading as well. That the book says that Ruthie wasn't able to kill Krem, but Supergirl was able to kill him. Mm-hmm. That's the ending of the book.
Right. Okay.
That's what I'm saying. It muddies the water further that she's like, no, I didn't kill him. I brought him to justice and put him in the, you know, And he appears to have been rehabilitated, or at least appears to have been to have faced his culpability, mm-hmm. you know, and the horror of his own existence.
It then, would have been like so much stronger of an ending if it had actually been the other way around. If Supergirl had killed him and Ruthie was like, well, I can't have the is like, yeah, now that's what, that yeah, I have yes. this eyewitness account of right. Supergirl, this like very important godlike person, mm-hmm. I actually can't go around telling people that she killed a man in cold blood. So I'm going to change the ending. And then they can have a conversation about why she changed the ending and what that means. Mm-hmm. But it, as it is here, what it does is it's kind of like the whole time Supergirl is like, or Ruthie is like, I'm going to kill that guy. And Supergirl's like, well, let's wait and see, right? Or you shouldn't kill that guy. Or actually, I'm not going to let you kill that guy, okay? Mm-hmm. And but they're still hanging out and they're still going on the quest. And then it's kind of like she wrote the book and she was like, and in the end, I was right. That guy did need to die, not expressed by me, a normal mortal, now 200-year-old space alien, but in fact, super final Kryptonian mega goddess and earthbound angel Supergirl decided that she was actually going to do that. Therefore, I was right, but I don't need to say that I was right because the book says so for me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Matthew, going back to you, if four people can't agree on the ending, mm-hmm. you know, is the book successful? And I think the answer is yes, because here are four people or the internet or the world or whoever having conversations, sharing their point of view on this. And I think that's great. And I think that every interpretation is good too, because it does give you an idea to say, oh, well, I hadn't thought of it that way, or I didn't look at it that way, or maybe I misread it in a way that you didn't. And so I think that that's valuable as well. And I think that when you can create a work, whatever that work is, that can get people to talk, to deep dive, to have, as someone says about Brad and I, friendly sparring, I think that that's a success. I don't know what you think, Matthew.
On the one level, I definitely see what you're saying, and I agree with it. I mean, you know, my daughter and I have had in-depth arguments about The Great Gatsby because they wrote an interpretation of it that they feel is absolutely 100% supported by the text. But every time we watch the movie, I'm like, nah, I don't think Spider-Man would have been. And she's like, shut up, you don't know. And I'm like, look, Spider-Man and Titanic did their thing and they're going off. But I also feel like there comes a level where if you were to try and say, break something like that down and say, here's the literal Cliff Notes version of The Great Gatsby, you would have some agreement about what the central thrust of that story was and about, you know, the central themes of corruption and money and blah, 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 and people are stupid. When it comes to this story, I feel like you guys definitely have different feelings on what the central thrust of the story is. And I really came to a point where I said to myself, again, this would be great if it weren't an established DC property. If this were like, you know, a super manalog or Supergirl analog character doing this, so we get to the end and the text says, haha, and then she killed him, I would have not have gone, oh. But because that did happen, and, you know, because we do have that question of if she's teaching Ruthie a lesson, what is that lesson? And when we get to the end of it, is that lesson learned? Because this story has its cake and eats it too. Supergirl didn't actually kill the guy, except that she did metaphorically, you know, killed his soul or whatever you want to call it. And then it ends with, you know, a literal kick in the face and, well, punch in the face. And I feel like, while you're right, I don't know that you being right is 100% applicable to this particular story.
Okay.
No, so here's Here's my issue with the with the way this story ended.
Okay.
What I enjoy about this book is kind of the opposite of what Matthew was saying. I like that this is a DC superhero doing something outside of planet Earth where she is basically being proactive and doing things, right? Superheroes tend to just kind of sit around in their home city and wait for something to break so they can punch it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Here, Supergirl is not trying to get involved like so many, you know, cowboys and barbarians and badasses and D&D characters. She gets involved in something because she was drinking at the time. And then just kind of has to basically see this all the way through, right? I enjoy that. And then at the end, there's this, I'm like, okay, yeah, so we've been doing, it's like a Western. It's like Supergirl's like Samurai Jack or like whatever, man. It's like, this is cool. I enjoy the journey. And then at the end is like, hey, I'm sorry, but I can't let you forget that actually Supergirl's a cop, and so are all superheroes. So what she does in the end is, instead of killing this man or letting him go free to live with the guilt of what he's done, she puts him in jail for 1,000 years. And at that point, I was like, oh, yeah, this is a DC character. Like, this is, she is a character with a big yellow or red S on her chest. In the end, what you do to bad guys is you put him in jail, because modern superheroes just naturally function on this, like, carceral, like, you know, the system is working perfectly fine. It's actually people who are outside of the system that are being bad. So let's, like, push them into the system. It's like, who decides who goes into the Phantom Zone? Apparently, there's wardens in the Phantom Zone here. Like, who are those people? Who elects Phantom Zone wardens? Who decides that? You know, it's that's what threw me off. The reason why I feel a lot of the panel wants to ignore those last few pages, for me, it's that. For me, I want to believe that Supergirl just went on this big adventure and at the end, either decided to kill a guy or decided to let him live. And those are the only two options, as opposed to, you know, basically brought him back to the post-Kryptonian industrial complex and had him, like, print license plates in the void.
What were you going to say, Rand?
I question that. I guess I've been thinking is that, does this story need to be a Supergirl story? You know, what I mean is, like, you know, what we're talking about, and again, I'm not responding in terms of, like, the plot, but I'm saying in terms of your question, even about, you know, can a story work if it has four different interpretations? You know, and what I mean is, like, you know, none of our interpretations, I think, are stemming, they're about storytelling decisions. They're not about our knowledge of the character of Supergirl.
Well,
what makes the story interesting is the stuff around that, not, you know, and in that sense, I think, you know, I'm not sure. We could talk about whether, you know, there's two different axes as to, there's, you know, is this a great story? Is this a great Supergirl story?
Right.
Sure. I think are two different axes.
What you're saying is this could have been like Goku from Dragon Ball Z.
Yeah. Because she's behaving in ways that I certainly have never, I'm not going to pretend that I'm intimate with the character of Supergirl, but, you know, it's fun to have Supergirl swearing and drinking, but I mean, is there any indication in any previous work that this would be in her character?
Right. And then that does bring up the question of, is the point to take the character of Supergirl and put her in this situation where she's basically playing Rooster Cogburn?
Right.
And then enjoy that, you know, that weird differentiation. And if that is the case, then I feel like you even more have to ask yourself the question of, when we get to the end of this story and we both have her kill and have her not kill, you've come to a point where it feels like we're making a compromise. And whether you're compromising to me and saying Supergirl doesn't kill, or whether you're compromising to Rodrigo and saying all superheroes are cops, and we have to deal with this, it comes to a point where it does feel like it weakens that climax, and it makes the story feel more convoluted than it needs to be.
That may be
because
true.
Because the character with the sword has a big red S shield on her chest. And so
I guess then the question is, as you, the reader, are reading the story, are you like, well, I know Supergirl. This isn't the way Supergirl would act, right? Mm-hmm. And so part of it might be you going, well, I know who Supergirl is. This isn't the way she would act. And you get to the story and it's like, see, she put the guy in jail just like the cop would do, right? Or you're looking at this and you realize that you have an unreliable narrator who is telling a story and you're like, what is the point of her telling this story that is not the Supergirl you know? Is it, I am creating a new mythology around this character? Am I trying to humanize Supergirl so she's not the god that everyone sees her as? Am I trying to villainize Supergirl? And I'm talking about Ruthie's writing, not Tom King's writing. You know, right. Why is Ruthie presenting Supergirl this way in the book? And is it to make you question, you know, who Supergirl really is?
That would be brilliant. Anyone could name five things about Supergirl, you know, and what I mean is that, you know, like, this is again why Supergirl, it'd be, you know, like, you know, if you're going to tell the story with a Green Lantern, you wouldn't do it with Kyle Rayner, you would do it with a Hal Jordan, you know what I mean, because we would immediately know, oh, it's an unreliable narrator, you know, because we know who Hal Jordan is. You know, the thing is, you know, everyone's saying this is the best Supergirl story ever. Is this the best Supergirl story ever? Probably. That's the problem. We need more.
Yeah.
Oh, we need more Supergirl. No, I'm not disagreeing with you there.
That's why I always say fourth edition is the best Dungeons and Dragons, because it's the least, like, Dungeons and Dragons like one we have.
Right. But, well, yeah, what I'm saying is, how do you deconstruct something that hasn't been constructed yet?
Right.
Deconstructing Supergirl. And, you know, I mean, like I said, if this was a Superman story, or, you know, you know, it would be, and like I said, don't get me wrong, I'm glad it was a Supergirl story. You know, Supergirl needs a story that's this visible, you know? And like I said, I feel like this is why this is going to be a great movie, because it's a great, you know, you could, all the stuff that we've been talking about for the last 20 minutes can be removed from the script. You know what I mean? Yeah. And it's still going to be a fantastic movie visually.
I mean, look at Guardians of the Galaxy, right? Like, that doesn't even actually follow necessarily anything from the comics. They just, like, picked up, like, five cool characters, some of which actually have never been in the Guardians of the Galaxy, I think, and then just called it that, slapped it together, and pointed it in the direction that Marvel wanted to go, and it was a successful movie, and people really liked it.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think that, you know, like, this will be, like I said, this is going to be a great, you know, skeleton to hang a bunch of, you know, organs and flesh on, you know, to make a really great Supergirl movie. And like I said, you know, maybe they'll find a way to deal with the stuff that we're talking about in a way that is compelling and interesting, or maybe they'll go another way and just, you know, work with the frame. Either way, I'm very curious to, you know, to see the film. And I have to say, as much as I, you know, started out by saying, you know, I'm not sure how I feel about this, I've over the last, you know, week or so, I'm finding myself thinking I really need to reread this book. You know what I mean? You know, at some point, because, you know, I'm sure I will, you know, pick up a lot more things now that I know where it ended. You know, maybe it'll make more sense to me.
And I think that sometimes that is the part of the hook too, is you reveal something at the end that makes you re-question everything that happened before. So you go back and need to rewatch it or reread it again. And each time you reread it, you pick up on something else. I don't know. I certainly have enjoyed reading this again. And I will probably read it again in a year. I mean, bottom line for me is I really enjoyed this book. I like it a lot. The art is out of this world, literally and figuratively. Bill Quist-Evely, in my mind, I just, every interpretation that she brings up is just wonderful. And I love everything she did in here. And I like the story too. I thought, as a tale of revenge and redemption, or whatever that, however you want to look at it. And I've enjoyed talking to you guys about this, because I do get some different perspectives on this. And that also adds to my enjoyment of this. So bottom line for me is I would recommend people definitely pick up this volume and read it. It's a good book. It's a good story. It'll give you that little bit of smugness when you go and see the movie and say, "Well, I read this when it originally was a comic book." You can be that person. So for me, I say go pick up this book. I enjoyed it a lot. Matthew?
First of all, I feel personally attacked by what you've just said. But I mean, it's definitely worth checking out. Even if nothing else, you can look at every single page, every single alternate cover. You can look at this and see why this was, you know, a big deal, prestige, whippity, flippity.
Yeah, and why it won awards.
Comic book. Yeah. And, you know, as Supergirl stories go, it is probably the most definitive Supergirl story that we've had in 15 years or more. But, you know, there's also that question of, hasn't Supergirl been an angel? Sure. Wasn't she a shape-shifting blob at one point? Sure. So can we keep this interpretation? That's what I hope. And whether we do or whether we don't, I feel like this is a book that you can probably look at and obviously talk about for many, many years to come. So it's definitely at least worth looking into.
All right. Rodrigo.
Did this have to be a Supergirl story? It probably didn't have to be, but it actually works very well because it is. Precisely for that reason, because the myth of Supergirl isn't as well known and ingrained, right? It's just like that couple of years where like Cyborg was on every team. The reason why you could put Cyborg in every team is because people didn't really know who Cyborg was and what he was about, right? So you could stretch that. And this does a lot of stretching. I enjoyed the journey of this book, and the ending doesn't really ruin it for me. But the art is fantastic. So I would say definitely if you want to see superheroes outside of that, I'm a guy protecting a city kind of place. This is going to be a good book for you.
Okay. And Rand, we're going to give you the final say.
All right. Well, my final word is I trust you, listener. The best thing about a conversation like this is that having heard all of this perspective, you know if you want to read this tonight or run screaming towards Spidey Super Stories, okay? So really, go with your, follow your own spirit on this one.
All right, there you go. Thank you very much, Rand. And that wraps it up this week, dear listener. Thank you for checking us out. If you found value in the show, we'd love for you to join us on our Patreon, where you can find more fun, including the Major Spoilers Podcast pre-show, where I go off on taxes, maybe a little bit too much financial information about Major Spoilers, but you can find it all at patreon.com/majorspoilers. So until next time, when Rand will be back again, and we are going to be talking about Superman Shazam First Thunder, we know that you love comics, and we do too. And we will talk with you soon.
Fat Dick's Ray Vision of Superman. I could save a few bucks and stand around and read through the covers of the comics on the stand. But although every other page would be backwards, I suppose, I could still read the evens and the odds. Well, I don't know. Guess I haven't thought this all the way through. Plus, as soon as the comic bookstore guy knew, they kicked my butt out on the corner. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. Think about a better way. If I was hulking green or gray, I could just bust through that brick wall, take their comic books away. But then the little meat would deal with all the tanks and bombs and guns. Have you ever tried to read a series with all that going on? Guess I need to rethink this plan. How would I back and board my comics with such huge hands? Guess I already told ya. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. Yeah, yeah, yeah. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. If I'm Stark Raven, it's like a man of iron. Might not be surprised if I'm that I might actually have the heart cold to follow an entire storyline. But would I really even need to read up on all those escapades? I mean, who needs such distractions when your sister's such a babe? But the downside is such a beast. Being shot up in a fun, me in the Middle East with a king sign throwing soldier. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. Yeah, yeah, yeah. What a major spoiler. Whoa, 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 whoa. What a major major spoiler.
This podcast is copyright 2023 by Major Spoilers Entertainment, LLC.